phone rather faster than others.
We sometimes literally run round the BBC building grabbing the very big guests.
Join us for daily news chats.
To get you ready for today's conversations.
Newscast. Listen on BBC Sounds.
It's midday and time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Black History Month began in America in the 1970s to celebrate the lives and achievements of African Americans. The event really took hold in 1976 when President Gerald Ford urged Americans to seize the opportunity of the United States bicentennial to, in his words, honour the too often neglected accomplishments of black Americans in every area of endeavour throughout our history. Well, today Black History Month is observed in many other countries around the world every year. The theme of this year's event in the UK is celebrating our sisters. So here on Private Passions, we thought this was a nice opportunity to revisit some of the inspiring guests who've chosen music written or performed by black women. Turner Prize-winning artist Helen Kammack wanted to celebrate the voice of the soprano Jessie Norman. She had just recently died when Helen and I spoke at the end of 2019.
The most incredible thing for me is absolutely her voice. So it's a soprano that has a kind of fullness and a breadth, and you can feel the emotion through every moment of her singing. So that, for me, is something that's really significant and important. And the other thing is, of course, what she represents for me. She's a black soprano singing internationally, I guess, over many years, where she was perhaps the only one doing it on an international stage with the kind of recognition that she had. And she really had to fight for it. She really fought for what she achieved. And so for me, this is about remembering her because she died so recently. And so I wanted to listen to her.
Thank you. Jessie Norman was singing Dido's Lament from Purcell's Dido and Aeneas. You were saying also, Helen Cammack, that music was part of your life growing up. And I think it all really began when, like so many young teenagers, you felt incredibly bored.
Yes. I was. We moved as a family. My father took early retirement and we moved as a family from West London to down to Somerset. He decided he wanted to live in the middle of the countryside. So we lived in not even a village. We lived in a kind of tiny hamlet in the middle of nowhere. And my nearest friends were miles away. So I taught myself to play the guitar. We had an old guitar in the house and started to write songs. And then my mum, who also loved folk music, decided, right, OK, I need to do something with this young person who's very bored, and took me to a folk club. And I performed in the round, as people are playing. And there was a promoter there, and he said, oh, that was wonderful. I'm looking for some acts to be support acts. And I just played a circuit around the Southwest for the whole of my later teenage, really. And my mum would take me, and then some of the clubs were quite large clubs, so she'd have to chaperone me because I wasn't old enough to be in them. So I'd make her sit right at the back while I did my opening set, and then we'd go home. So, yeah. Yeah. It was great.
You yourself experienced significant racism, I think, as a child growing up in the 80s.
Yes. As a child in London, they were kinds of individual incidents on the street, people shouting, name-calling, those kinds of things. But actually, the shock to the system for me was moving to Somerset. So moving to a place where we were the only black family in the school, and they didn't hold back. They'd shout across the street, get back where you came from, to a point where I didn't want to go shopping anymore.
Do you think that has got better, or is it residually still there?
I think it's not just residually still there. I think it's still there. I think the political climate at the moment is allowing it to reside across our society, loud and proud as it wants to be.
Has that experience in any way filtered into and influenced your work as an artist?
I mean, it's about who I am. As an artist, you everything you make is somehow a communication of who you are, whether you think you're doing it or not. That's what it is. And so it's absolutely part of who I am. I'm sure all the elements of lament, the idea that I want to reach back into history and bring stories forward, much of my earlier work was very much about race and the politics of colonialism. And I know that's as much about a kind of interest and a passion that's about history and injustice, but it's also as much about me and my own pain.
The artist, Helen Cammack. The music of the composer Florence Price has enjoyed a welcome resurgence in recent years and has been chosen by two of today's guests. First, the writer, photographer, musician and broadcaster Johnny Pitts, who was brought up on a housing estate in Sheffield, the son of an African-American father and a mother of Irish descent. Like Florence Price, Johnny's grandmother relocated in the Great Migration of the early 20th century, when 6 million African-Americans fled the racism and poverty of the rural South. In 2015, he travelled to America to try to find out more about his grandmother's life.
Yeah, well, I was lucky enough to go to the small town where she was born and raised, which was Ola in South Carolina, to make a documentary for Radio 4. And, I mean, it was astonishing. It was like one of those real tiny towns with a few trailers, a water cooling tower and a single railway track running through it. And I remember looking around there and thinking, you know, it must have taken real bravery for this. I mean, she was 14 when she made that Great Migration alone. She was a sharecropper, you know, she picked cotton in the South. And, you know, I heard stories when I was in Ola from a 95-year-old man. He was the oldest resident in Ola. And he was telling me how, you know, some of the reasons why African-American people would have wanted to move away from the segregated South, you know, it was tough times for everybody, but they would get paid much less than anyone else. And when they would buy food, even at a grocer's, the grocer would put their thumb down on the weighing scales and charge African-American people more than white people. So it was a very tough time. And I think Seppi, my grandma Seppi, is a real hero to me for wanting to build a better life, not just for herself, but thinking of future generations. And so she made that trip at 14, ended up in New York, and then worked for a Jewish family as a maid, and then made her way in New York and got settled in that kind of enclave of blackness, which is Brooklyn. And that's where my dad was born and raised.
If it was difficult for women of that descent anyway, imagine being the first African-American woman composer to be recognised as a symphonic composer, in fact. And that is what we're going to explore now, because it's music by Florence Price, isn't it? The first African-American woman to be performed by a major orchestra. She and her family moved north during the Great Migration to escape the racism in Arkansas. Lynchings were really quite frequent. Is that why you've chosen to hear her? Does the experience resonate with that of your grandmother?
Yeah, well, my grandma made the Great Migration in 1930, and Florence Price wrote this piece very shortly after, I think in 1932. And when I hear it, it strikes me as a kind of victory march for my grandma. I hear that in this music, and yeah, it's very evocative and very touching, actually. I mean, the sociologist Paul Gilroy talks about this notion of black vernacular culture and how sometimes the struggle of the black community is encoded in music in kind of opaque or abstract ways. And I definitely hear that in the work of Florence Price. I hear that struggle, I hear that bravery, I hear that tenaciousness.
We're going to hear the second movement of her Symphony No. 1, premiered in 1933 by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, after that move north. And it was the piece that brought her considerable national recognition.
Thank you.
The second movement of Florence Price's Symphony No. 1, performed by the Philadelphia Orchestra, conducted by Yannick Nézet-Séguin. I'm Michael Barclay, and you're listening to Private Passions on BBC Radio 3, and a special edition for Black History Month, celebrating the lives and the music of black women. And for details of all the music played and all the guests featured, head over to BBC Sounds. Novelist Nadifa Mohammed fled her native Somaliland in northern Somalia when civil war broke out. She was only 4 when she came to Britain in 1985. On Private Passions in 2021, she spoke of the difficulties women still face in Somaliland and recalled her early memories of the civil war.
We would focus on getting people out. So that was the job of my parents, to find out where people are, grandmothers, aunts, uncles, cousins, and see what could be done to help them. So there were these cassettes that would go back and forth and take forever to arrive and to get back to us. So that was one way of keeping in contact. And you'd hear the voice of your grandmother or my uncles. Phone calls, and I remember my mum would take me to the phone box and she would just hammer all of these pound coins into the slot because it was so expensive to ring a refugee camp in Ethiopia, so it'd be £15 for a 5-minute call.
I know you sometimes listen to those tapes still, and it must be very haunting to hear those voices.
It really is. And again, some of my family can't, but I make myself because it's important. And there's both a joy in it, hearing my grandmother, you know, whispering and joking and telling stories from before the war. So being able to hear it directly from them as it happened is really fascinating.
What is difficult about living in Somaliland?
I think it's not the things that people would assume. Somaliland has been safe for a long time now. And it's somewhere that, you know, people leave cash and jewellery that they're selling out on the streets and go off and pray and come back and it's still there. So it's very safe. But what I would find difficult is life for women. And at the moment, there's a really terrible law that's about to be passed, which would basically legalise marital rape and underage marriage and a whole bunch of other really awful things. So, you know, there is protest and there is resistance to that. But it's a place where I think certain conversations are still too far behind, especially when it comes to women.
A rich crossing of cultures in this next music with the Malian kora player Toumani Diabate and the American blues artist Taj Mahal. Is it this juxtaposition that attracts you to the love song? It's a love song, Queen Bee.
Yes. The minute I heard it, I thought, wow, this does something to my soul. And it's the combination of the languages as well. So there's a female vocalist from Mali singing along with Taj Mahal. And it instantly felt to me as if there was a conversation happening across centuries of the people who stayed in Africa and the people who were taken away from Africa. And they were reuniting in this love song. And to me, it feels like a love song between a mother and a child, a lost child. She's berating him. She's comforting him. I don't know what the lyrics are, the Malian lyrics, but the tone of her voice and the love in her voice is clear. And, you know, this has been a year of thinking about what that Black Holocaust really was, what it meant and what it still means, and how the context of slavery, the history of slavery, the consequences of slavery have not been tackled in America, in Britain, and in Africa.
Honey in your honey pie, part the body of the heart. Honey in your honey pie, on the pot is what you got. Ooh, my soul. Rock me to my soul, my baby, 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 to my soul. Rock me to my soul. Watching and look at her around. Strut and shake some. Dance and having fun. Love me to my soul. Rock me to my soul, my baby, baby, baby. To my soul. Rock me to my soul. Oh.
Baby, to my soul, rock me to my soul. Sweeter than a honeybee, baby, been sweet on me. Sweeter than a honeybee.
Queen Bee by Taj Mahal and Tumani Diabete with the vocalist Ramatu Diakite. Kadiatu Kane Mason grew up in Sierra Leone before coming to live with her grandparents in Wales after her father died. She is now the mother of seven remarkably gifted young musicians, including, of course, the cellist Sheku and pianist Isata, both of whom took leading roles at this year's BBC Proms. In 2020, Caddy talked about just how the children relish their role as ambassadors for young black musicians, and she also addressed the question of prejudice in the classical music world.
I don't think the classical music world in itself is racist. I don't think classical musicians are racist. I think what it is that children from diverse communities do not get access to that world. So it's a question of expense, it's a question of cultural barriers as well. I think they are often made to feel that it's not their world and it doesn't belong to them and they shouldn't do it. And so by the time it gets to conservatoire level, they are not the musicians there with the skills, with the background, with the education and the level in order to enter these conservatoires, which means that so many orchestras are 99% white or completely white. And also you see it reflected in audiences, because I think if you're not introduced to it, if you're not made to feel that it's also part of your own culture, part of everybody's culture, you're not going to go to those concerts and be part of that audience. So I think it's not the question that a certain field is racist. It's a question of who has access.
Do you think that your family now bears a bit of a burden, the burden of black representation in classical music? And is that a responsibility? Because as soon as somebody becomes a celebrity, we throw everything at them. And there's so obviously a sense that because Sheku is played so much, people might say, oh, well, good, we've ticked that box.
Yes, that's a huge concern, the idea of tokenism. And Sheku and all the children are very passionate that they cannot be the only ones. So Sheku always says, OK, I've opened the door and stepped through. That door has to be kept open. I want other people to come through as well. And he's always
so happy when a child, a black child, will come up to him at the end of a concert and say, look, I'm playing this music, I'm playing the cello or another instrument simply because I've seen you do it and that's why I started. And he gets that a lot and it's just a wonderful feeling and he takes that role very, very seriously. And I think it's very important that they do take that seriously because it's an ongoing struggle, an ongoing battle.
Samuel Coleridge Taylor next. A pioneering composer in many ways, the kind of ways we've been talking about. And I think we're going to hear three of your children playing it.
Yes, this will be Isitor on the piano, Breimer on the violin and Sheku on the cello. And what I love about this piece is you can hear all their personalities and it's something that they arranged themselves. And so it has all their own feeling in it. And for me, Samuel Coleridge Taylor was a composer who I loved as a child. I actually had his poster on my wall. And the reason I loved him was because his father was also Sierra Leonean and he was mixed race. And his music just spoke to me. And the piece, of course, Deep River, from the black slave tradition in the United States, is something that means a lot to the children with their heritage in the slave histories of the Caribbean. And this is a piece which for me is on two levels. It's a piece about freedom and it's also a piece about dying and going back to Africa, which is home.
Deep River, the traditional spiritual inner version by Samuel Coleridge Taylor, arranged by the performers there, three of the Kane Masons, violinist Breimer, cellist Sheku, and pianist Isitor. Saxophonist Yolanda Brown, whose CBeebies programme, Yolanda's Band Jam, brilliantly introduces young children to the joy of music, grew up in Barking in London in the 1980s and was exposed to lots of different music styles by her Jamaican parents.
Yes, my dad has the most wonderful vinyl through to cassette through to CD now playlists collection that cover all genres. And, you know, growing up, there was never a set style of music that we would hear. So, of course, to understand my heritage, reggae, ska was there, even from the origins with Mento and Naibingi Beats was always there. But then through to opera, classical music, soul, Motown. And I just loved the variety of colours that we could have in our house. You wake up on a Saturday morning, time to do the chores, and you just never knew what Dad was going to choose. And I think that really informed my musical taste later on down the line, and also when I come to write my own music.
Do you still feel quite a strong connection to Jamaica?
I do, yes, especially now. I was there this summer and it was wonderful. I'd been there many times, always to play, though. A lot of my family have now moved to America, but my brother, who's a couple of years younger than me, had never been. So he went, he brought his family and his children and partner, and the same with me. And my parents came as well. So we went on a full discovery tour of the great grandparents and the origins of the Brown family name. And it's just wonderful to have a connection with your heritage and your roots.
You describe your music, Yolanda, as posh reggae.
Yes.
You even sell T-shirts with the slogan posh reggae on them. What exactly do you mean by that?
I love the idea of reinterpreting music and being able to say what I want to say. I play the saxophone, so I don't have words. And so for me, it's very important to be able to create an atmosphere and a story. And I found through experimenting that my natural rhythm is reggae, jazz and soul. And I can't choose one. And every time I go to an interview, they'd always ask, but what genre do you play? And I said, for me, it's just music. And I remember being in Australia a couple of years ago. And as a joke, someone said, what is this mix called? And so I said, well, we're in a jazz club, it's sophisticated here, maybe we'll call it posh reggae. And then it just had legs of its own, and there's baby grows and t-shirts and caps and the rest that people love to sport the slogan. So it's been nice that everyone's embraced my natural rhythm, so to speak.
And if listeners are trying to identify what makes this reggae,
yes,
give me an example of what they should listen for rhythmically.
They will feel it, but it will be in the bass line for this one. Boom, ba 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 da da da, boom, 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 ba da 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 da, dum, dum, dum. And that laid back feel that we're talking about, that's very important for this piece.
Thank you.
Million Billion Love from Yolanda Brown's 2017 album Love, Politics, War. Like composer Florence Price and Johnny Pitt's grandmother, writer Isabel Wilkinson's parents relocated in the Great Migration, in their case to Washington, D.C. Isabel wrote about the 20th century exodus of African Americans from the poor economic conditions and discrimination of the rural South in her best-selling 2010 book, The Warmth of Other Suns. She started out as a journalist and in 1994 became the first woman of African American heritage to win the Pulitzer Prize for Journalism. When did you know, Isabel Wilkinson, that you wanted to become a journalist?
I wanted to be a writer. Journalism was the route to becoming a writer. And there's a distinction in that journalism is a particular kind of writing that allows a person who wishes to be a writer to be able to make a living. But underneath it all, I was always seeking to use narrative. Narrative is not often possible in daily journalism. But I've always been that. I've never done anything else. This is all that I've ever done. Writing is just central to me. Obviously, the clarinet was not going to work out for me. So that wasn't going to be a possibility.
Well, I think we all have to be grateful that you shifted to the writing. And you did very well, because by the age of 30, you were a Chicago bureau chief for the New York Times.
I never considered anything else, so I was able to focus in on this. I was very methodical in my approach to the work because this is all I ever wanted to do.
Would you say you have a formidable determination?
I would say that, as my mother did.
Now, the next music is from the soundtrack of a film, the 1981 Diva. Why this?
It was the first time that I had seen a depiction on the screen of someone who looked like me, but who was not the stereotype that we've all grown accustomed to, that has been a staple of Hollywood from the beginning. This was a woman who was a renowned opera singer who was, in fact, so acclaimed that a single recording of hers was so valued that people were willing to do almost anything to get a copy of it. And that was the basis of this film.
Cynthia Hawkins, wasn't it?
Cynthia Hawkins was the singer's name, but
she was portrayed by the soprano Wilhelmina Fernandez.
Correct, yes. This was the first time I'd seen anything like that. But beyond that, though, the music was haunting. The music was enchanting. The music was transporting. And combined with the visuals, it was something that I'd not seen before nor heard, and it stayed with me.
Thank you.
Soprano Wilhelmina Wiggins Fernandez with the London Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Vladimir Kozma, in music from Alfredo Catalani's opera Le Valis, recorded for the soundtrack of the 1981 film Diva. I'm Michael Barclay, and this is a special edition of Private Passions for Black History Month, celebrating the lives and music of black women by revisiting some of the many amazing guests that have featured on Private Passions in recent years. Go to BBC Sounds for details of all today's music and guests. The American jazz singer and pianist Nina Simone has always been a popular choice. One of the many guests to have chosen a Simone track was the author Kit Duval earlier this year. Kit grew up in Birmingham in the 60s and 70s with a Caribbean father and Irish mother, and had to come to terms with three distinct identities.
We were brought up in mostly the Irish part of Birmingham. My grandmother came from Wexford sometime in the 30s. And my father, of course, was a member of the black community, the Caribbean community. He was a bus driver. Lots of bus drivers were from the Caribbean. And then, of course, we were Brummies. We were Birmingham children. And we learnt really early on this code switching that goes on when you come from different communities. So I would speak to my grandmother with a certain vocabulary and a certain music to my language, and I knew what I could talk about and what I couldn't. And then we had at home a black grandmother who lived with us. We called her Black Nana. And I had a different language for her, same meaning, different vocabulary, different diction, different music. And then I had my own voice for my friends and for school. You don't know you're doing it when you're a child. You just do this inflection to be understood.
Do you think this is what led you to write so wonderfully about children and the way they think?
Yes. I mean, it helps to be immature, and I'm quite immature. but yes, I do remember having to learn pretty quickly and pretty invisibly that this was how you interpreted the adult world.
Now, the next piece of music is from an opera, a wonderful opera, full of marvellous melodies, Gershwin's Porgy and Bess, a story about black people written by a white man. So it's had a controversial history.
Yes.
But your take on it is?
My take on it is that the sentiment of this song and of the opera itself is one of truth. It's about drug dealing, it's about gambling, it's about prostitution. And the criticisms of it have been that here is another story where black people are living those kinds of lives instead of a celebratory story about success. But for me, it was the reality of many lives at the time. This speaks to many, many black people.
And you've gone one further than just the opera, because you've got Nina Simone,
yes,
singing I Loves You, Porgy.
Yes, and she has taken that song and she's put her own agonies into it. You can hear her agonies in the song. She's not singing it. She's living right from beginning to end.
I love you, Porgy. Don't let him take me. Don't let him handle me and drive me mad. If you can keep me, I wanna stay here with you forever. And I'll be so glad. Someday I know he's coming back to call on me. He's going to handle me and hold me so. It's gonna be like dying, Porgy, Daddy, deep inside me. But when he comes, I know I'll have to go. I love you, Porgy.
me. Don't let him handle me with his hot hands. If you can keep me, I wanna stay here with you forever. Got my man.
Nina Simone at Carnegie Hall in April 1964 with her version of I Loves You, Porgy from Gershwin's Porgy and Bess. Well, to round off this special edition of Private Passions celebrating black women, we'll return to the music of Lawrence Price, this time chosen by Theaster Gates, the potter, sculptor, filmmaker, curator of black history, real estate developer, and professor of fine arts in Chicago, where he lives. Theaster Gates' provocative art and installation projects around the world include a library for Barack Obama and the 2022 Serpentine Pavilion building. I wondered if he saw any limits to his ambitions.
Well, honestly, it feels like one total project. You know, I love being a creative person. I feel incredibly curious all the time. And as long as I continue to treat life as a series of minor problems to be solved, then anything might be art. And that's very exciting to me.
Well, you're not, as we've heard, a man who stands still. And it leads me nicely to your final music. This has the wonderful title Nimble Feet. It's by Florence Price from one of her final works, The Dances in the Canebrakes, a piano suite from 1953. And you wanted to hear the orchestration by William Grant Still. This music is dear to your heart?
It is very dear to my heart. It has the feel of a kind of Gershwin response to the black experience, but it's actually written and orchestrated by people of color. As I learned about classical music, I could only imagine that great classical music was made by white people. And that what I really came to understand as I entered college and later on through my own research was that there have been people of color making fantastic music as long as music has been made, and that in some cases the challenge of the Western canon is that people were overlooked. And Florence Price, I mean, come on, she's one of the legends, you know? And I thought ending with Price's music for me is a call back to joy, of human joy, of black joy, of the possibility of a celebration, even in tough times. And Lord knows if we've ever needed a celebration in tough times, it's now. So thanks to Florence and thanks to you, Michael, for this amazing opportunity.
Florence Price's Nimble Feet, orchestrated by William Grant Still, ending today's special edition of Private Passions for Black History Month. It was presented by Michael Barclay and produced by Graham Rogers. For details of all today's guests and the music they chose, do head to BBC Sounds, where you can also explore hundreds of previous editions. Next week, Michael's guest is the comedian and actor Chris Addison. BBC Radio 3 on 90 to 93 FM, digital radio, BBC Sounds and on most smart speakers. Just ask for BBC Radio 3. It's 1 o'clock, time for the news, read by me, Jane Royce. Israel has again told Palestinians living in the north of the Gaza Strip to move south ahead of an expected ground attack. The Israeli military's continued its intense bombardment of the territory 2 weeks after Hamas gunmen killed more than 1,400 Israeli civilians. Palestinian officials say more than 1,800 children are among the 4,600 people killed in Gaza since then. Aid agencies are hopeful that more aid will enter the Gaza Strip through the Rafah crossing with Egypt later today. Yesterday, 20 trucks delivered medicines, water and food for the first time since Israel started its siege of Gaza. The UN Children's Agency has warned that without deliveries of fuel, the lives of 120 newborn babies on incubators in Gaza are at risk. The Immigration Minister, Robert Jenrick, insisted that ministers are doing absolutely everything they can to secure the release of British nationals being held hostage by Hamas. He also said he expected Israel to strike in a surgical way, but it was entirely likely that more civilian lives would be lost in Gaza. The Environment Agency has warned that major rivers could still be flooded until Tuesday as a result of Storm Babette. Train services remain disrupted across parts of Scotland, Yorkshire and East Anglia. Iranian state media says a teenage girl who fell into a coma after an alleged encounter with officers over the wearing of the hijab is now brain dead in hospital. The Iranian authorities have denied that Armita Garavand was hurt in a confrontation with officers who were enforcing the strict Islamic dress code on the underground in Tehran earlier this month. Police are searching for three prisoners who've absconded from the same open jail in Suffolk. Joshua Terry, Levi Mitchell and Aidan McGuinness were all reported missing yesterday from Hosley Bay Prison. Football fans have been arriving at Manchester United's ground at Old Trafford to sign a book of condolence for Sir Bobby Charlton, who died yesterday at the age of 86. Sir Bobby survived the Munich air disaster to have a distinguished career at United. He also helped England win the World Cup in 1966. And the weather, there'll be patchy cloud and sunny spells in Wales and western parts of England and Scotland with a few scattered showers. BBC News, it's 2 minutes past one.
Sound of Gaming on BBC Radio 3.
Hi, I'm Ella Silly Woods, your new host for Radio 3's monthly Saturday show celebrating music from the world of games. Come with me as we explore some amazing pieces of immersive music. In my first episode, I'll be joined by composer Enon Zur as we explore open universe games and the importance of their musical accompaniment.